Today I'd like to talk to you on the theme, the background of 20th century philosophy. It certainly, as you can well understand, a theme that's too large to exhaust. You can hardly touch it in 1 hour. I wrote a little diagram on the board. In those squares or rectangles, I have listed three of what I think to be the main philosophies of our day. And then five of the men surrounding them are the five men whom I have chosen to give you just a little data on. And I think that the arrows will show the influence that these men have had on our present day philosophies. In the case of Hegel, you will notice that I have an arrow pointing toward pragmatism, an arrow with a cross through it toward logical empiricism and existentialism, which simply means that I think he had an influence on the latter two, but it was much more negative than positive in that they reacted against him. Without any more introduction, then, I'll simply give you a very short summary of what I think to be some of the most important aspects of the philosophies of these five men, and I'll just have to leave it to you to try to tie them up with the modern philosophies, because we simply don't have time for that today. Hegel, first of all, was certainly the most important philosopher of the last century. He has one distinction in that he was one of the few philosophers who was understood and also popular in his own day. He dominated philosophical thinking pretty much until the turn of our last century. He has also had an effect upon practically all the philosophers of our century and many of the living philosophers, either positively or negatively. Many of them have reacted very violently against him. You need only think of Kierkegaard, who was listed there, or G.E. Moore, or Russell, James, many other more modern philosophers. I don't intend to discuss his philosophy of history, but rather a little bit of his logic, just giving you a few ideas of it, because here I think he has had some effect upon modern pragmatism. Hegel's whole system of philosophy begins with what he calls his new logic, which he believes is an improvement upon the old Aristotelian logic of the past. Reality, according to his system, then is not a series of entities, but rather what he would call a continuum. Reality, then, is an infinite and continuous thing. This meant that he, first of all, felt that he had to deny Aristotle's principle of contradiction, the principle such as this, that a thing cannot both be and not be at the same time. A thing is either red or it is not red. Now, Hegel would simply say that a thing may be red and it may not be red at the same time. What would he do then with Aristotle's whole principle of contradiction? Well, he'd say that it's both true and false. It's partly true and partly false. And therefore, for the old logic of distinction, which Aristotle had taught, Hegel substitutes a new degree of truth logic, as he called it. This logic he called dialectic, and it consisted of three stages: thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Every thesis has its antithesis, and together they merge into a synthesis. Let me just give you an example of this, perhaps to see the way his thinking went on this whole matter. His basic triad in his logic was the triad of being, nothing, and becoming. Here's the way he dealt with that. Being he defined as the most primitive, the bare minimum of concepts. It wasn't a substance, it wasn't a quality, it wasn't a cause, it wasn't an effect. It just is. In fact, this minimum is so minimal, so bare, that it's nothing at all. So here we see being passing over into its antithesis, which is nothing. And so we have something which both is and is not at the same time. Being and nothing are both the same, and yet at the same time, they're different. And this identity in difference is his synthesis, which he calls becoming. Now, if you have a hard time understanding whether that is logical, it's simply because he breaks so radically with what we usually think of as logic, namely Aristotelian way of thinking. Let me give you another example. His main triad, which was being, essence, and nothing. Here again he uses the term being, but gives it an entirely different meaning. According to this dialectic, being is just the simple matter-of-fact, intuitive, naive way of looking at things, at the world. Essence, on the other hand, he says, is the critical view, which refuses to judge things as they seem to be, but forms all sorts of concepts and relations and so forth. Then the synthesis between these two he calls notion. Now, he worked an entire logic of these triads. Everything that was could be classified according to these triads. And then the sum of this entire gigantic logic of his he called the absolute idea, which we perhaps could call God. Since reality includes everything, nothing less than the whole, he said, is completely understandable. You can never know the whole truth, you can only know a portion of the truth, and the truth is constantly something that's growing. In this sense, you couldn't get outside of his whole system in order to judge it or look at it from the outside. He was a monist in the same way as Spinoza was. And so he believed in what Bertrand Russell today has called the unreality of separateness, which meant this, that reality is not a self-subsisting entity of some kind, but the reality of a thing consists in its arrangement or in its context. An illustration which Russell brings out of that would be this. If you take a brick out of a building, it's simply not the same thing as it was in that building. The unreality of separateness. A thing's reality is only in its larger context. The absolute idea, according to Hegel, was not then a simple substance, but a very complex substance. It is the absolute idea, as he called it, and he said that this was pure thought thinking about itself. And world history is constantly approaching this absolute idea. Now, that's a very, very brief summary of some of his ideas. On the basis of that alone, you might just wonder what in the world was his appeal in his day. And certainly he has very little appeal to many people today. Well, the reason probably was in the whole situation in his day philosophically. There had been a great deal of skepticism in the past, and here he came out with something quite positive, something that people could believe in. There had been a great deal of disagreement, radical disagreement among philosophers in the past, and here he comes out and says as much as this, that there's a little bit of truth in everything, and a rather optimistic opinion in every way. And so he offered a very positive and a very complete account of things, which would seem to appeal to many, many people. And he was a very confident, dogmatic philosopher, which also seems to get converts easier than those who are more humble in the position that they embrace. Hegel, I believe, has had a real effect upon modern pragmatism in their idea of truth. And I think that as you study pragmatism later, perhaps you'll be able to see that. The next man to be considered is an English philosopher by the name of John Stuart Mill. Again, I have no intention of giving you an overall view of his philosophy, but just a couple of points. And these points are not necessarily the most important aspects of his philosophy. Mill is a man of whom you can say two things. He was, first of all, a rationalist, and secondly, a liberal, and consistent in both of those. In other words, he believed that you can come to knowledge only by using the data of human experience. And then secondly, he believed that the greatest amount of liberty of thought and action was the surest way of attaining knowledge. And these two facts regarding the man are brought out in all of his many works. First of all, I'd like to mention a little bit about his theological position. because I think it has had an effect upon modern pragmatism, although his theology, he would certainly say, is not the most important aspect of his philosophical views. He was brought up, as you may know, in a very strange manner. He was a very precocious young boy. He never went to public school. His father educated himself, the boy himself, and he was brought up without religion and was taught a very definite distrust and dislike toward all organized religion. And yet in his later years, he felt a need of religion, and the fact that he had never been brought up in any traditional religious environment, I believe, conditioned the rather cold, hard conclusions that he came to. He wrote three essays on religion. And in these essays, he tries to argue for the existence of God on the basis of the argument from design. He felt that this was the only argument for God, and certainly the best, far better than arguments which had been used, the argument of natural selection and so forth. And so he argues for a creator of great but limited power. The whole creation, he feels, speaks out against the omnipotence of God. The very idea of design, for instance, the very fact that you're arguing from design would show a limited power in God. In other words, if God had to select means to an end in order to do his creative work, then he is working under obvious limitations. What about the omniscience, then, of God? Well, this to Mill is more of an open question. He certainly realizes that a great deal more knowledge is to be found in God than in us. And yet whether God is omniscient is a question which he simply doesn't care to answer. What about the other attributes of God? Benevolence, say, or justice? Well, Mill believes that these two attributes certainly cannot be reconciled. And so his conclusion is simply this, that in God there is some benevolence, but no justice. Let me just read then his whole conclusion. These, then, he says, are the net results of natural theology on the question of the divine attributes. A being of great but limited power. How or by what limited, we cannot even conjecture. Of great and perhaps unlimited intelligence, who desires and pays some regard to the happiness of his creatures, but who seems to have other motives of action which he cares more for, and who can hardly be supposed to have created the universe for that purpose alone. Such is the deity whom natural religion points to, and any ideas of God more captivating than this seem to come only from human wishes or from the teaching of either real or imaginary revelation. It's been said that Mill was interested in all his religious writings in saving natural theology from the skepticism of Hume, who lived the century before. Now, Mill's argument for God is certainly different from the modern pragmatic argument of William James. And yet, they come to almost precisely the same conclusion regarding the nature of God. Namely, that God is a benevolent but a limited being. And I believe that in studying a man like Mill, you'll find that he is actually arguing pragmatically just as much as James was. He is arguing here, whether he understands it or not, from his own need, his feeling of need for God, although he doesn't use that as a definite argument. Then just a word about his ethics, utilitarianism, as it was called. Mill is regarded as a philosophical radical, and he regarded himself as just that. The word radical coming from the Latin word radix, which means root. In other words, the root question of any matter was what he was interested in. And the root question, he believed, in regard to ethics, was this: whether a law or an institution made for human happiness. That was the basis of ethics, he felt. And so he condemned, on the one hand, all ethical relativism, which would simply say that I feel that this is good, therefore I think I should do it, and also any naturalistic ethics, which would say that whatever is unnatural in some way or other cannot be right. He said that action must be for the sake of an end. A thing is right by virtue of its consequences. And the end is one's happiness, not one's own personal happiness, but rather the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people in general. And he launches into a very elaborate defense of this ethical theory against all objections, probably the best defense ever made. Now, this idea on his ethics, I think, too, has caught on in many quarters, and certainly we can see the influence of Mill, both in social ethics and in politics. By the way, he wrote a great deal on politics, and certainly was a popular man in this country because of his political views. And also pragmatism, I think, in its whole doctrine of ethics, approaches this view of Mill very closely. So much then for Mill. The next man that we take up is Comte, a French philosopher and considered by some to be the father, certainly one of the progenitors of modern logical positivism. Comte was interested only in the area of epistemology. And his position regarding epistemology was very clear and simple. He believed that every claim to knowledge can be justified only by scientific methods of inquiry. In other words, the method of science, he says, is the proper method of philosophy, the method of knowledge itself. And therefore, theology and metaphysics were simply not within the domain of philosophy, he felt, or the domain of knowledge. He lived immediately after the Napoleonic Wars, and it's been said that the horrors and terrors of those wars had a very profound effect upon him. Anyway, he had a very natural bias toward all the old ways of thinking and doing things. In other words, belief in God or the soul, immortality, belief in some ultimate reality, belief in natural law and so forth, all these things were not only vain things to talk and think about, but they were very harmful. They were responsible, he felt, for all the misery and misfortune and misunderstanding of the past. And therefore he advocated getting rid of all these things and coming under the cover of new positivism, which he was teaching. He was also dialectical in a sense. Like Spencer and Marx and Hegel, he taught that there were three stages of history. The first stage was the theological, or the mythological. The second was the metaphysical. The third was his own positive stage. The theological stage of existence would consist of polytheism, merging gradually into monotheism, an idea of the world as though it were created just for man, the idea that God was behind specific events in the world. That stage of history crumbled with the science of Galileo, Copernicus, and others. And it merged into what was called the metaphysical stage, which was really only a modification of the first stage. In this stage of history, there is the attempt to explain metaphysics by reason or by will, to explain the ultimate reality of all things and so forth. You see that stage represented in Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, and others. And then finally, there is the positive stage. And in this stage of history, the problems of metaphysics, the problems of philosophy, many of them, are simply bypassed as futile problems, and science takes over, so to speak. Science alone is accepted as the source of all knowledge. And this was the gospel that Comte preached. To him, science was basically empirical, which means that ordinarily you take a hypothesis and try to prove or disprove that hypothesis by the data available. He also did a great deal of work in trying to classify the sciences, and people still think highly of him in this area of his endeavor. He worked against reducing all the sciences to one particular science, such as physics, which other men had tried to do. He also did some pioneering work in the whole area of sociology, as you can well imagine, with his interest in history, And I believe he invented the term sociology, which we use today. Later in his life, he changed and he became religious in a sense. What I mean by that is that he made science a basis for a new religion of humanity, as he called it. A positive religion, which he felt would simply supersede all other religions, and especially Christianity. Maybe just a word on this new religion of his would be interesting to you. According to this religion, he would accept all the good in all religions of the past, but he would discard all error and superstition. This great new religion of humanity, of course, would supersede any idea of God. Before, in the world, men had worshipped imaginary things, he believed. But here, man would worship man, something alive, something present, something dynamic. And the power of this religion would be that the object of our worship would need our worship. And therefore, we would be having the worship experience and at the same time ourselves progressing. He worked out this religion in a very intricate fashion. It had its high priest and its whole cult of priests. The high priest, naturally, would be Kolt. It had its Virgin Mary. She was used as a symbol for pure humanity. It had a system of ethics, which was supposedly higher than any other ethics before. Private worship was based on the highest type we can find in humanity. And there was even prayer in this religion. In fact, he spent many hours of his life in prayer. But prayer was not asking for things. Prayer was identifying ourselves with those things about humanity which are the best and which we adore. Now, if you took away this last part of the thinking of Kolt, you would find that modern logical positivism goes along pretty well with him. But no doubt, because of these strange religious antics of his, modern logical empiricism wants to dissociate itself as much as possible from Kolt. And their high priest today is much more Hume, who lived the century before. But it's certainly true that Kolt has had some great effect upon the thinking of modern positivism. The next man to be taken up is Kierkegaard. One hardly knows where to start in talking about this man. And I suppose what I'm going to give you here is rather disjointed. He was not a systematic philosopher in any sense of the word, and therefore when you give his views, one man will have one whole body of ideas and another man will have another. But I'll try to say a few things that might be interesting about him and things which show his bearing on modern existentialism. His life was a very uneventful life. And perhaps the very fact that it was so uneventful is something that conditioned his philosophical and religious views. He studied for the ministry, but he never took a call. He never did anything in his whole life except study and write. He died at a very young age. His home life was of a rather morose, unpleasant nature, and I believe that that probably conditioned his thinking to some extent. Let me just name a few of his ideas. First, Kierkegaard, in his works, continually stressed the incongruity and the meaninglessness of the world. Philosophy, he believed, simply cannot penetrate this darkness. And the only way that we can escape it is by a leap of faith. In other words, we must become Christians. And so faith, he says, is opposed to philosophy. Kierkegaard would have regarded himself as a religious thinker before a philosopher. When philosophy delves into theological questions, then it commits a basic error. It's going into a sphere that it knows nothing about. And it invariably produces some sort of false absolute which denies the disparity between God and men. Now, he says the essence of Christianity is simply that disparity, the fact that God is another, that God is someone apart from us, a thou, someone with whom we are in relation, all of us. We have a relationship to God, either a relationship of estrangement or a relationship of reconciliation, but always a relation. Faith, then, he says, is always related to the disparata, to use the technical dogmatic term, of Christ's two natures. In other words, the fact that the Son of God was born and died, or the fact that a man performed these miracles. And faith is always concerned with that and directed toward that. And so there's no rational explanation for faith, he says, any more than there can be a rational explanation for the union of the two natures in Christ. They're beyond comprehension. He's well known for his idea of three stages of existence. It might do well simply to mention this. He believes that there is an aesthetic stage, an ethical stage, and a religious stage. And existentially, their importance, of course, is in ascending order, you might say. According to the aesthetic stage, life is just a matter of chance. A person just goes along and he curses or is happy for his good luck. One can't escape this, the fact that life crowds in on him, and so he attempts to create some sort of a new world for himself by plunging himself into work or into some sin, perhaps, or into a life of pleasure, something like that. In this stage of existence, man is always living for the moment, and he's ethically a skeptic because he wants to avoid all responsibility, ethical responsibility. The next and a much higher stage of existence is the ethical stage. In this stage of existence, man becomes aware of his moral conflict, of his ethical responsibility. He realizes that there is a universal morality which makes demands upon him, but the trouble is that he usually thinks that he meets those demands, and he becomes pharisaical and self-righteous. And so this stage of existence actually becomes a hindrance for man to enter into the final, real stage of existence, the religious. In this stage of existence, then, man actually exists before God. He doesn't leave the ethical stage by some way of thinking himself out of that way of his existence, but rather by a leap into the religious, by simple faith in God. And this leap is made only after a man sees the bankruptcy of still living in the so-called ethical stage of existence. In this stage, man, the religious stage, man exists before God. Faith, according to Kierkegaard then, is always a commitment to God. In all his works, religious and also philosophical, he emphasizes this activity of faith. The fact that faith is something which lives in a person and makes a person do certain things. The faith of Abraham, for instance, being able to walk for 3 days with his son and never turning back, knowing all the time that he has to kill that boy. Kierkegaard does not speak so much of the passive aspect of faith, the fact that faith is a simple trust in the mercy of God. He doesn't speak so much of the fact that faith justifies. He doesn't speak so much about certain fruits of faith, such as peace of conscience and so forth. Now, the reason, perhaps, is that he simply wasn't concerned with those things in his particular context. Always emphasizing, however, the activity of faith. Next, a word about Kierkegaard's idea of existential thinking. He believed in objective truth. But he wasn't concerned with that. All objective thinking, for instance, thinking in matters of science or history, can be shared and communicated, he thought, verbally. In religious matters, however, to make one man's thinking another man's thinking, cannot be made through direct communication, he believed. Because faith is an experience, and the other person must simply have the same experience that you have. And therefore, for you to see that this other person attains the same experience, the only way is to try to put that person into a position where he can have the same experience that you have. But You can't talk him into it. You can't argue him into it. In fact, Kierkegaard, in one of his books, speaks for, I think, over 100 pages on the difficulty of communicating the Christian experience to one who has not had it. Subjective existential thinking, he believes, is a continual striving. In other words, there's always an uncertainty in life. The uncertainty which exists because of the fact that we are at the same time a finite creature and yet an infinite spirit. And so thinking is always thinking against the possibility of being in error. Faith is always believing against belief. Hope is hoping against hope, and so forth. He believed that historic and scientific truths, objective truths, cannot serve as proofs for eternal truths. I think that's very important because much of modern theology has followed him in this with some very serious consequences. In other words, he would say the claims of Christianity are not direct philosophical, provable propositions, not even the case of the resurrection, perhaps. But a leap in every case is required. He believed also, following Lessing, that a quest for truth is better than any objective certainty. In other words, there is a truth which can be had without committing yourself. And there's another truth which a person can have only by committing himself beforehand, by being personally involved. And that is the subjective truth of a Christian. And a person's personal concern always remains. A word about Kierkegaard's idea of Christianity. Here I think he's very close to Luther. He stressed in all his religious writings that I have read the paradoxical nature of Christianity. For instance, just take his idea, a few of his statements regarding Christ and Christ's life. You study the life of Christ, Kierkegaard says, and everything connected with that life is wrong. Christ does everything wrong. He associates with the wrong people. He gets the wrong kind of disciples. He doesn't provide for his future. When he has a chance to get a great following, he declines the opportunity. He gets mixed up with authorities, says things that he wouldn't need to have said, and then finally winds up making an enemy out of almost all people and being crucified. Now that's the life of Christ. On top of all that, this man, Christ, makes absolute demands of people. Who can believe it? It's so paradoxical. And yet, Kierkegaard says that the offense of Christianity is not to be found primarily in that paradox. The offense is to be found rather in us, in a moral problem that we have, rather than an intellectual one. Namely this, that we refuse to admit that we need another to atone for us in order to bring us forgiveness of our sins. And the second reason why people are offended at Christianity, he says, is this, that Christianity is suffering, always. The disciples were offended because they couldn't stand the prospect of seeing Christ suffer. And the disciples today are offended because they don't like the prospect of suffering themselves. And that is essential to Christianity, he says. Now this idea that Christianity is suffering conditioned Kierkegaard's whole idea on what the Christian witness was to be and on what the Christian church should be. It conditioned his whole attitude toward the church of his day. He believed, first of all, that there was no witnessing without suffering. That means voluntarily suffering, courting controversy in your witness. A life which is comfortable is simply a life which is not spent in witnessing for Christ, he believes. His attitude toward the state church of his day then would be a very negative one. The state church Christianity was a very comfortable, complacent type of Christianity. Everybody was baptized, everybody was a Christian, just as a matter of course. And that is completely contrary to his old idea of Christianity. Christianity in his day, he said, was dead. The very essence of Christianity, he said, is to suffer, which the church was not doing, and to be in a minority. And here the church was the entire country. Now, I may say a few more things in conclusion on Kierkegaard after talking a little about Nietzsche, if we have time. Now, Kierkegaard, I might say, has had a very profound effect upon all modern existentialists, and certainly those existentialists who call themselves Christians today follow along with a great deal of what Kierkegaard, what I've outlined for you of Kierkegaard's ideas now. The next man is Nietzsche. Nietzsche is certainly one of the most provocative thinkers and philosophers of the last century. Like Kierkegaard, he was pretty well neglected and not thought much of during his life. And it's just been lately that Nietzsche has come out as a great philosopher in the minds of many people. He was pretty well written off by most of the recognized philosophers at the turn of the century, and they felt that he had nothing important or original to offer. I think the first thing to understand about Nietzsche is that he was, first of all, a historian of culture. That was his great interest, and that is what brought about his very radical thinking on so many points. All his efforts center around this one interest, to study the cultures of various people, ancient and modern. And what he understood by culture was culture in the broadest sense. It would be art, religion, science, politics, ethics, and so forth. His studies in this area left him with one inescapable impression, namely this: the relativity of cultural values. All values, he concluded, are relative to time and to place and to the particular needs and conditions of the people who have adopted that particular culture. Then, correlative to this conclusion that culture was relative, is his contention that the highest qualities of any culture are always to be found, they always flourish, during the earliest period of that culture. And as the culture grows old, or as the civilization grows old, the culture always declines. He would give the example, for instance, of Rome in its golden age, as contrasted to Rome at the time of its decline and fall. Or he would give the example of the Germanic people as they reconstructed the whole Roman Empire, and then the Germanic people of his day, where they were embracing a decadent philosophy, a decadent art, a decadent literature, and where they were just going along in their ease, having all they needed, and not realizing the misery that they were in. Nietzsche's greatest contribution, if a person dares to call it a contribution, is in the area of ethics, because he approached the entire ethical problem in philosophy from a radically new and different point of view. Just take one question in ethics, say the question of honesty. How would a Christian deal with that? He would say, it's good to be honest, it's right to be honest because God says so. Kant would have answered the question differently. He would have said, honesty is right categorically, simply because it's right and for no outside reason. John Stuart Mill, as we mentioned today, would have said honesty is right because it gives the most amount of happiness to the greatest number of people. Now, Nietzsche doesn't approach the question in that way at all. He says this: why should one say that honesty is right and dishonesty wrong? I don't believe it. In other words, he'd say, by what right do you assume that some things are right and other things are wrong? And so he questions if there is any basis for right or wrong in morality. Now, what's his answer? His answer to this question is simply this: that man makes his own morality. In the past, he believes we've had a slave morality. He identifies that with the Jewish Christian tradition. Now, he says, we're going to have a different kind of morality. This slave morality held even the greatest men in bondage. Perhaps it's well just to listen to what he says about slave morality. Here's a quote. Christian morality is the most pernicious form of the will to falsehood, the denial of life. It is not error as error which infuriates me here. It is not the age-long lack of goodwill, of discipline, of decency, of spiritual courage, which betrays itself in the triumph of Christian morality. It is the ghastly fact that what was unnatural received the greatest honors as morality and remained suspended over man as the law of the categorical imperative. This is the great blundering. To teach contempt of the primal life instincts, to set up a soul, a spirit, in order to overthrow the body, to teach men to find impurity in sex, to look for the principle of evil in the need for expansion, to see higher moral value in selflessness, in objectivity, in neighbor love. These things are the will to nothingness, the denial of life, the great nay-saying. Now, what does he offer in the place of this so-called slave morality? He offers what he calls master morality, the proud, exalted kind of morality which says, I take this thing, it's mine, I defend it, I stand up for it. In this master morality, there's nothing cowardly or timid or utilitarian or self-abasing or dog-like, as Nietzsche says. Man determines his own values. The essence of this morality is man's own pride in himself, confidence in himself, faith in himself. I think the greatest example of this type of morality, if you've ever read any of the Norse sagas, you'd know what Nietzsche was talking about. He praises those sagas, where they simply turn morality upside down, those old Norse gods and heroes. Nietzsche calls himself the first immoralist. He says that he is the one who has finally felt Christian morality beneath him. He is the one who has unmasked Christian slave morality. Now, Nietzsche's opposition to Christianity, however, is not simply because of a moral idea that he had. He rages against Christianity not simply because it fosters a type of weak morality which keeps strong men bound in chains. His antagonism goes deeper than that. Nietzsche simply cannot believe in Christ as a savior. In other words, he cannot believe in a God who becomes incarnate, becomes one of us, comes down to our level, and into our whole situation on earth in order to save us eternally. No, says Nietzsche, we have to remain faithful to the earth. And we can't be poisoned by any false, nebulous hope of an eternity just to keep us happy and to keep us going in this life. God is dead, he says. There's no longer any need for celestial, nebulous hopes to carry us on and keep us happy. We must live for this life. And it's not only that God does not exist. That isn't what is meant by the fact that God is dead. Nietzsche means the very usefulness of the idea of God is dead. And that's what he means. And so Nietzsche, turning morality upside down, performing what he calls the transvaluation of values, actually becomes strikingly similar to many of our modern atheistic existentialists. It's fundamental to existentialism of the atheistic variety that man makes himself, that man makes his own essence, that man makes his own morals. Now that, for instance, is the position of Sartre. It's also fundamental to modern existentialism that a man's conscience and a man's ethical standards are conditioned by himself, not by anything outside, an authority of any type. Now that is exactly what Nietzsche, you notice, taught here. And this is man's anguish, according to Heidegger, again a very close similarity to Nietzsche. Another affinity which he has to modern existentialism is this, that Nietzsche's atheism and his immoralism are militant. In other words, this isn't just some conclusion he's come to and then wants to forget about it because it's unpleasant. He really believes in this thing. This is really a gospel to him, and he preaches it with the same sort of zeal that a gospel preacher of some other gospel. He has a great deal of confidence in the power of his own insights. And even if he isn't recognizing his day, he knows that one day he will become a great man. And listen to what he says about that. I know my destiny. I am not a man. I'm a fatality. I'm dynamite. Someday my name will be bound up with the recollection of something terrific, a crisis, a profound clash of consciences, a decisive condemnation of all that before me has been believed, required, hallowed. I am the voice of truth. So he had a great deal of confidence and belief in his own disbelief. I just listed here, before I came, three areas in which I believe both Kierkegaard and Nietzsche of the last century have influenced existential thinkers today. One, I believe, by their extreme individualism. In other words, both of these men will appeal to any man who wishes to rebel against mass thinking of any kind and who wants to rise above the level of the herd. The word herd is a quotation from Nietzsche. The second area where I think they have influenced modern existentialists is in this, that their entire philosophy, their way of looking at life, is centered in man. And there is no interest, no sympathy with philosophical speculation or metaphysics. You have Kierkegaard's violent reaction to Hegel, for instance. And this also is common in modern existentialism. You have men like Camus saying that no man ever died for the ontological proof. And that to him simply says the word that can be said for philosophy. It's useless. Nietzsche says, where you see ideal things, you, the philosopher, I see human things, alas, all too human. And then the third area where I believe that they've had some effect upon modern existential thinking is this, that they don't believe that it's desirable necessarily to be rational. You have Kierkegaard reacting against Hegel. You have Nietzsche reacting against John Stuart Mill. And you have the existentialists today too, not putting any great confidence in human reason, but going on studying man as he is in his predicament. Now, I thought certainly I wouldn't get done today, but I must have been talking faster than I thought. So I thank you very much for your listening.
I think we have a few minutes of time. I certainly want to thank you very much, and I think we all profited a great deal by it. And about this Norse song, you know these Norwegians, you Norwegian aren't you? They're really smart people. They had boards before we did. Okay, now, any questions? Yes, here is it. Mr. Fackler, would you mind that? Mr. Fackler,
how much?